So we're beginning to look at the life of David. One thing you'll know about David, just by a casual overview of the Bible, is a great deal is said about him, isn't it? A great deal of detail is said about David, more so than those that we are well known, that are well known, like Moses, more so than even the founding fathers of long ago, of the people of faith like Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob. In fact, there is nothing in ancient history quite as detailed and focused upon one person than that of David, which means, whatever else, it means that there's something about him, or something about who he represents, or something about his office that we need to pay attention to. David was known to be a great king. Moses was known to be a great leader, a great prophet. Abraham, a man of faith. But the world looks in a way to a king, in a way it doesn't to a prophet or to a man of faith. To a king, what does the world hope for? A king is a person who will bring rule, who will bring peace, who will bring about in everyone's life a place whereby we can live our lives to hopefully its fullest. Without a king, without one who governs this world orderly, in peace and with justice, problems are going to arise, aren't they, in life? God's appointed king was David. He was described, as we looked at previously, as the one upon whom the Spirit rushed, the one who was full of the Spirit of God, the one whom was described as the anointed one of God. And as that person, he provoked hostility, he provoked reaction against all those who are anything but anointed, who, if you like, had their own interests at heart rather than God's. And we see that play out between Saul and David. Yet the harder David was pushed, the more it seems he was loved, the more successful he seemed to become, the more he was loved by people. We get a sense of that in this passage that we've just read about, and we'll look at that in more detail. Let's look firstly at the title I've got here. It's from 1 Samuel 18. It's becoming the person loved by God. Becoming the person God loves. And the first thing is that we want to see from the opening passage, how is it that people can face adversity, face difficulty, face trouble like David did, and yet shine, and yet be people who show greatness, who show that they are above, in some sense, the circumstances around them. They're not so controlled and crushed by them, though they may be wounded, though they may be hurt. The first thing I want to say is that we need to see what brings courage in facing adversity. I forgot the point. What brings courage? Courage comes through joy. In the midst of trouble, we need joy, because it's from joy that we find courage. If we look at the first few verses together, we see here a friendship between David and Jonathan. We read here that Jonathan was knit, verse 1, Jonathan was knit to the soul of David, and Jonathan loved him as his own soul. He was knit to the soul of David. I'm not a knitter. I've never put a cross thread. I don't even know all the terminology. But I imagine when you put two or more threads together in such a way that you do when you knit, the hope is that eventually when the job is done, it won't all fall to pieces, because what would be the point? When things are knit together, they are held together tightly, aren't they? That when they are in strain, in stress, they don't come loose. Well, here we have a relationship between Jonathan and David that was to experience all kinds of strain and stress, but it didn't become all untangled and fall to pieces. Jonathan was knit to the soul of David, and it's said that he loved him. There was a deep friendship. Now, what goes on here in this early account is that not only did Jonathan love him, but he did something extraordinary. His relationship with David could have been a very dangerous one, because whenever you look at Jonathan, you have to remember that he was, at that time, the prospective king of Israel. He was going to take the place of his father Saul. So he would be in the place of power, and if he had someone whom he dearly loved, they were going to be in a place of influence, a place where they could have the ear of the king. We see it, don't we, in stories, in movies, where, you know, you go back into medieval times, and or even in the political sphere of life today with the cabinet, and the president or whoever, the king has the ear of a trusted advisor. It's a powerful thing, isn't it? But actually here, something even more powerful is going on in the privilege that David was to be given, because we see Jonathan doing something extraordinary. In verse 4, we read this: Jonathan stripped himself of the robe that was on him and gave it to David. Not only his robe, but he also gave him his armor, his sword, his bow, and his belt. What was going on there is something that actually happens, there are accounts of it in medieval history even, although this, granted, is much earlier than that. But the idea being to bestow upon the future king recognition of their coming authority. They not only were sworn in by promises, but also there was demonstrations of that through giving the vestments of honor to the future king, from the king himself. And Jonathan here, what he's doing is he symbolically is giving his robe to David. That robe was a picture of a king, the office of a king. He gave him his armor, a picture of the king whose role was to be the protector of his people. He gave him his sword, a symbol of his power and authority over the people, his bow, his belt. He was giving David, essentially, the office that he himself would otherwise have fulfilled at the death of his father Saul. He was saying by this, in effect, you, David, are to be the next king. He just saw in David something greater than himself to be able to do that. He didn't do it reluctantly. We know from what is said here, he loved David. What he did was took tremendous courage. We know from later on how Saul was angry against the prospect of David rising to power, and even felt deep anger against his own son for the relationship Jonathan had with David. It was a courageous thing to do, to give over his prospective future to one who he believed was greater than himself, one who he believed was God's anointed one. It takes joy to act courageously. Jonathan was a man who had an attitude of joy that gave him strength to do the courageous. If we could have the next heading, next verse, please. In Nehemiah, it says, "Do not sorrow, for the joy of the Lord is your strength." Joy can bring us the capacity to do great things. What Jonathan did was courageous. Amy Carmichael said, "You can give without love, but you cannot love without giving. That was one of the texts that we saw played up last week in the evening when we were looking at the Africa Inland Mission and some quotes from old missionaries. You can give without love, but you cannot love without giving. Well, Jonathan loved David. And what did he give? He was giving his kingship. He was giving his rights. From his cultural background, he was giving it over to David. He did so because he had joy in recognizing that God was working in David, that God had a purpose in this man that was greater than in himself. Joy differs from happiness. Happiness is merely circumstantial. Maybe today you're happy because the sun is out. If it rains tomorrow, I hope it doesn't, but if it rains tomorrow, we might be gloomy and miserable. Relationships can bring us happiness, but they themselves are bound to change because we are never every day of the week emotionally satisfied with our spouse, with our friends. They let us down and we let them down. But joy, unlike happiness, which is a small boat in a big ocean that gets tossed and turned, joy is an attitude of life that is able to face the gritty realities and work through them and not be overcast by them. It's a discipline of the heart. It's an attitude that Jonathan demonstrated throughout his relationship with David. He continued to love him through thick and thin. If I eat vegetables instead of steak, I'm fairly sure that over time I will lose weight because I'm not taking in as many calories. Similarly, if I discipline myself to a life of inner joy, that I say my hope is in God and I look to Him, I am not to be mastered by circumstances. That diet will turn me, and if it's of you, will turn you into a person of greater courage, of greater generosity than you would otherwise be. Paul says this, if we can have the next verse, speaking of urging love between brothers and sisters to give generously, to care and love one for one another. How does he frame that? How does he encourage us to care for one another? He commands us, he says to us, rejoice. Rejoice in the Lord. Again, I will say, rejoice. He urges us to help these women who labor with me in the gospel, with Clement also, and the rest of my fellow workers whose names are in the book of life. Rejoice in the Lord, he says. Again, I say, rejoice. If we want to be courageous, we need joy in our life. We need joy looking to one greater than ourselves, like Jonathan did. Saul didn't do that. Saul was a king whose courage failed him. Saul was a king who let people down, whose promise fell to the ground. The problem was that it wasn't that he lacked courage so much because he was a coward, but that he had no joy. Saul was known, as we read in these verses, as a man of fear. You will see this time and time again, that he was a man who feared. He lived in fear. If we read in chapter 18, verse 12, we have these verses. Saul was afraid, hear that word, he was afraid of David because the Lord was with him, but had departed from Saul. Wherever David was sent, he was successful. We see that, don't we? We see that whatever he put his hand to, God blessed him. But when that happens, it invites a reaction from many people. If we could have the next quote, please. There's an actress who says this. Betty Milder, a Hollywood actress, says this. The worst part of success is trying to find someone who is actually happy for you. Now, think about that for a moment. Isn't it true? It's some part of your life. Someone has had something that you have perhaps longed for and have failed to achieve it, but someone else has, and you think that's not fair. You get disgruntled, you grumble. It's hard to find someone who is genuinely happy for your success. But David lived in success, but he also invited a reaction from people who didn't like it. And one person in particular, and that is Saul. We see it in these verses whereby he comes back from war and there's a joyous celebration. The women come out, there's song, there's tambourines, there's music, there's joy. And there's this little song that's sung, Saul has struck down his thousands and David his 10,000s. And the reaction of Saul is that he was very angry and the saying displeased him. He started to put the pieces together. You would note from the time when David conquered and defeated Goliath, Saul made inquiries as to exactly who this man was, who he was connected with. He did his investigations and no doubt along the line came to hear of Samuel and of his anointing of David and was troubled deeply. And he has hit it right on the head when he says in verse 8, towards the end of verse 8, he says that they've ascribed to David 10,000s, and to me they have ascribed thousands. What more can he have but the kingdom? Everything seems to be going David's way. And what can I do about it? So from then on, Saul keeps an eye on David, meaning that he views David as a threat. He views him with suspicion. He's looking at David and his every turn and plotting his downfall. What's going on in Saul's life? His attitude utterly contrasts with that of his son Jonathan, doesn't it? Jonathan loved David. He had joy for David's success. He was willing to give courageously his own office, his own entitlement to the office of king, because he saw that this man was worthy because of what God was doing in his life. Yet Saul hated it. Saul was angry by it. He was envious. And we see that envy, we see that rage come out, don't we, in this account. When David was with him playing music, as he did, Saul hurled a spear at him and tried to pin him to the wall. But David, by the grace of God, evaded him. The verse that we just read, verse 12, speaks of Saul as afraid because he saw the Lord was with him. The Lord was with him. That phrase, the Lord was with him, is actually echoed again in the next verse, verse 13, although we don't see it so clearly in our translation. Saul removed him, that is, removed David from his presence. Literally, it is Saul departed from David. The Lord departed from David, and Saul departs from David. Isn't that true of people in the world? If you reject God, you push God away, it follows its course that you will also push away things that remind you of God, people who remind you of a lifestyle that you ought not to be living because of a holiness and a presence that makes people feel uncomfortable. I wonder, are there people that you know of who've pushed you away because they see something in you of your holiness, of your love for God, that they find uncomfortable? Or are people all too familiar, uncomfortable in our company at times? Saul fails to pin David down. So he plots and he schemes. He undermines David in other ways, at first that seem clever and underhanded. He hopes that by sending David to the forefront of battle, David will get himself in a fix and be killed by the hands of the enemy, the Philistines. But this proved unsuccessful as well. He arranges a marriage for David. But in the first instance, possibly frustrates David by not honoring his word, wanting to provoke him, to get a reaction from him that will bring out, he hopes, the worst in David. Envy is an ugly thing, isn't it? It's wanting to see not goodness prevail, but actually evil. He is plotting, he is scheming to hurt David. And he sets about a marriage, not for the goodness of David, not for the goodness of his daughter, but so in the hope that David would be fallen by this union. It says, doesn't it, in, where are we? He talks of giving his daughter Michal to David, not for her good, not for his good, but that she might be a snare to him, that she might be a snare to him. He was a man racked with envy, so much envy he was willing to hurt his own daughter that he might gain David's downfall. In the Ten Commandments, the last commandment is, thou shalt not, do not covet. It in a way wraps up all the destructive power of sin. My family had a bout of illness about a month ago, and they were taking tablets that were in little capsules. These capsules were sugar-coated, but inside they would release chemicals that would heal, hopefully, the body. Well, envy is like a sugar coating, but what it releases is toxins for the soul that wound, that grieve, that create bitterness, anger, that well up a pattern and an attitude of behavior that is destructive. Saul's life is breaking down. You see that, don't you, from this passage. He is a man gripped by envy. He wants David down, and he'll do anything to achieve it, even hurting his own family to gain it. Envy is eating up the calories, as it were, in Saul's spiritual life, leaving Saul a man who's starving, who is on the way to self-destruction. It's true, we see it in the words of Proverbs. A tranquil heart gives life to the flesh, but envy makes the bones rot. Saul's bones are rotting and rotting away. But the law of God applies, of course, as much to you as it does to Saul. He's made the world, and he's ordered the world as much for you as he has for the people of old. Are you in danger of starving yourself? Is something eating you up in your life? I see it could be something like friendship. I've seen friends who've broken apart because they become friends with someone else, and the person who has lost that friendship feels hurt, perhaps betrayal, isolation, and wants to see that friendship, that new friendship, maybe be broken down because there's jealousy, because they are not getting what they once did, but they see someone else getting it. They're not being fulfilled as they once were, but they see someone else receiving goodness, if you like. Envy has an attitude of breaking down, of bringing, of wanting hurt, of wanting isolation, of wanting pain upon another person's life. You may see it at school, behavior like that. But it's not confined just to the school or to young people. Adults can be capable, of course, of envy, as Saul demonstrates as well. You know, we can think of someone who's successful, someone who maybe has done well in life, is prosperous, someone who is, enjoying life. And we might say, oh, how wonderful, you had the opportunity to go on that fantastic holiday of a lifetime. Yet inwardly, if we're honest, at times we think, well, yet how worldly that person is. We think and judge and criticize that person, though we may not speak it outwardly. What are we doing? Our heart is telling us something that is contradicting what we want to present, that there is always the temptation to envy, to want, and if we can't get, we wish that others wouldn't get it either. Saul was racked by it. And envy, if it holds any one of us, will destroy us. However, how then do you conquer something as powerful and as destructive as envy? Some people say, well, you've got to look at your talents. You've got to remember how gifted you are, what people you have in your life, and try and think positive thoughts. Weigh out the negative by thinking of the positive. Maybe that was Saul's problem. He wasn't thinking enough that he was a king, that he was a man in power, that he had sons, that he had a future. Was that his problem? Well, the trouble is, it doesn't work. Envy is so powerful that you cannot think your way out of it. It will always sweep you along, and you will ride its current. Some of us have gone to Abu Dhabi, and there's a tidal estuary. And we know, if you've been there, how strong that current is, so strong you are not to swim in it, because it's so dangerous. You cannot swim against the tide. And no matter how hard you try, no matter how much you try and think positive things, it doesn't work. It is not the antidote. The antidote is what we see at the beginning. The antidote is the attitude that Jonathan displays, that of joy, that brought him to a place where he could be a person of courage. He, through joy, was able to relinquish, was able to give up what was his, because he saw in David something greater, because of what God was doing in him. Can you do that? Can you think, whatever you face this week, is there something that you need to give up because there is a greater cause, that God has his name upon it? And have joy in that. Have peace in that. Because through that, you will serve. Jonathan's heart was knit to David. He loved David because he saw God was anointing him. He saw God in David. The people saw something of that as well in their love for him. They came to him in their droves. Jonathan had courage because of joy. Saul was racked because of envy. We are called, in the next point, to love someone even greater than David himself. David was loved by Jonathan. David was loved by the crowds of people who saw his success. We see yet, though, he was even loved by Michal. Love is a great thing, isn't it? It brings us to do courageous things. There's a verse that speaks of the power of love. In verse John 1, 4:18 says, there is no fear in love, but perfect love casts out fear. Speaking here of love for one another, having in the context, loving one another. Perfect love casts out fear. Jonathan loved David. Saul feared David. There's a contrast that goes on here. If you look at it, if you look through, you'll see in verses 1 and 3 and 16 and 20 and 28 speaks of the love for David in those verses from these people. But there are verses in verse 15, 12 and 29 speaks of the fear of Saul toward David, the fear of seeing what is panning out before him, of losing his grip. But David was not a perfect man. Though he was a great man, he was not perfect. We read here in closing that Michal loved David. It's the only verse in the whole of the Old Testament that speaks of a woman's love for a man. Not because women didn't love men, of course, that would be nonsense. But it's the only one time that is actually noted. And therefore, it is highly significant. We read here, verse 20, Saul's daughter Michal loved David. She showed that by her actions when eventually Saul banished his secret plots and went all out against David. She protected David by letting him escape and providing a cover for him, risking her neck for David. She showed in her actions, remember, that love gives, true love gives, doesn't it? She was a woman who showed and demonstrated some courage out of her love for him. And yet we read, if we follow on eventually, that her attitude changed from one of love to one where she despised David. You don't need to turn to it, but in 2 Samuel 6, we read of David dancing before the Ark of the Covenant, of bringing God's covenant Ark back into Jerusalem. He was dancing outrageously, perhaps out of pure joy and song, and she saw him and thought of him and despised him in his acts of indignity. How can a king behave in such a way? And the words that end of her life were that she no longer bore children. She didn't bear children. David spoke to her and said that he acted in a way that he was not ashamed of. And may all who saw him delight in what he did. But she was left. She was left to live, possibly, the text doesn't say, without ever being near David again. We don't know. But what brought a woman who loved David, who protected him, to a place where she despised him? Something was not right. Whatever we know or imagine, something was not right. David, it is never spoken of, in his relationship with her, showed love toward her. He always spoke of her in official terms. The verse ends, actually, of her account in the Old Testament as the daughter of Saul, the title that she possessed. Maybe she was useful to David, we don't know. Whether she was any more than that. Now, David was clearly a man of character. We read that in the Psalms. He was a man of love, but he wasn't a perfect man. He was a man who had many wives, wasn't he? And no doubt jealousy was provoked by it. Yet people loved him, despite all of his failings. But there's one we ought to love even more than he, a better king, a true king. The one who, it says, he knew joy, a joy found in us, a joy where he was willing to face the cross. For the joy set before him, he endured the cross, despised its shame, that he might gain you and I. Speaking of Jesus, the King of peace, the King of justice, the one whom we are to love above all else, Jesus Christ. He empathizes with us. He draws near to us. He touches us. We see, don't we? I was preaching this afternoon in Plas Cymru Cron, the blind men that Jesus passes by, but he doesn't just ignore them. He touches them. He gets alongside. This king is not far. He's not removed from our experience. He empathizes with us. He doesn't, like the kings of Saul and the people who follow suit like him, manipulate us through taxes, through bringing us low that they might be enriched by our being crushed. This king was willing to be crushed that we might be healed. This is where David ultimately pointed to Jesus Christ. The love that people responded, like Jonathan, to David. How much more worthy is the Son of God, the King of Kings, who was crucified upon the cross, that we might love him, that we might give our whole allegiance to him. For he has promised peace and justice. He's promised fullness of life if we come to him. A hope for eternity, not only in this life, but forevermore. He's the King who not only commands us to rejoice in him, but he promises to love us as well. He loves us and shows his love to us, as we're going to see now in a moment, before the table of his broken willingness to be broken, to be forsaken upon the cross, that we might be accepted in his presence, that we might be made co-heirs with Jesus Christ, the King of Kings. That's the one whom we worship.